everyone. Welcome to the 320th episode of the Internet of Things podcast. This is your host, Stacey Higginbotham, and your co-host,
Kevin Toefel.
And wow, this show is going to be big. We're talking about two of the hottest trends this year in the smart home, plus the Colonial Pipeline. So we're going to talk about the new name for Project Chip. We're going to be talking about, yes, Colonial Pipeline, and we're going to be talking about Amazon's Sidewalk network. Plus, we've got lots of news from new Amazon Echo devices, new Wyze earbuds. We've got yet another security flaw allowing for attacks on Wi-Fi networks. And we've got a new product from Finn, the smart water metering company. Plus, our guest this week is Kevin Poe, a senior product manager at Google. And he's going to be talking to us about Matter, which is the name of the, well, it is what Project Chip has formally become. We're also going to hear from our sponsor, Very, about their hardware strategy, and we've got some good questions for you on the hotline. So let's kick this show off with a message from our sponsor, Very. Are you looking for an IoT development firm that has been there and done that? Very's award-winning team of senior engineers, designers, and data scientists will work with you to get your biggest IoT hardware and software projects fully operational. You can learn more at www.verypossible.com. That's www.verypossible.com. Okay, the big honkin' news is...
Finally.
Yes. Project Chip. This is the smart home interoperability standard that Amazon, Google, and Apple and Samsung all proposed way back in December of 2019. We have been talking about it since then because the promise is that it will make all of your smart things or smart stuff work together. As we have discovered more information, we realize that not everything will work together. It doesn't cover all devices, but it covers many. And we have also been waiting for it. They said it was going to come out in the end of 2020, but really it's coming out in fall of this year. And we'll finally see certified devices come out late this year and early next year.
I will give them a pass on missing the deadlines given the pandemic.
Global pandemic.
I can do that, yes.
So what has happened? There are two things that have happened. Project Chip is becoming Matter. So the brand name for the protocol is going to be the Matter Protocol. So now going forth, we shall say Matter, formerly known as Project Chip, and the alliance that is going to handle all this is going to be called the Connectivity Standards Alliance, or the CSA. And that alliance was formerly known as the Zigbee Alliance. So this is going to bring up a lot of questions for people like, hey, what the heck is going to happen to Zigbee? And what? So.
Yeah, I've already seen some comments on the interwebs about this is all about to kill Zigbee. And I can't understand why the Zigbee Alliance would want to kill Zigbee. So that makes no sense to me.
We're going to tell you.
Yeah. And just to mention also, there's a nice new logo. And I only mention that, not that we typically hear about logos, but because it's a standard like Bluetooth and Wi-Fi, and those have logos, so you know that those radios are inside those devices. There's a new Matter logo that will likely appear on devices.
Yes. And we'll show you a picture of that if you want, but it's cute. We knew all the way back in 2020 that if Matter, formerly known as Project Chip, got off the ground, the Zigbee Alliance, which was in charge of that working group, was going to have to change its name. Because any smart home interoperability standard backed by all of those companies and doing what it wanted to do was going to become bigger than something like Zigbee. So all the way back then, we were like, hey, what are you going to do? And the Zigbee Alliance was like, yeah, maybe. We'll see what happens. So now the Zigbee Alliance is the Connectivity Standards Alliance. With that, it is expanding to cover Zigbee. So Zigbee is still part of the Connectivity Standards Alliance. Matter is also going to be part of that. And they're going to push for some other smart home interoperability standards. They're not talking about those yet, but if you check out the newsletter, you're going to find out about one of them. And they're also going to get more into lobbying and participating in kind of what they call the global IoT worldview. I don't know. They don't call it the worldview. I'm calling it the worldview. They're working with the World Economic Forum to set kind of standards around security and privacy and all of these things that we love and care deeply about with the smart home. Basically, this is an expansion. Instead of just worrying about Zigbee, the Connectivity Standards Alliance is going to worry about connectivity standards for, they would say, the smart home and smart buildings. Mm-hmm. That's another thing. Matter is also, they're pushing that forth for, they say smart buildings, it's really smart apartments. That's the focus. And the idea being that if you have Matter embedded in light switches and blinds and whatnot in apartments, then residents can come in and bring whatever they want into that ecosystem. And as long as whatever they bring in is Matter certified, it all works together, which is great.
And you mentioned not all devices that we traditionally think of would be initially supported, but there's still a good wide variety.
Yes. Matter will certify lighting devices, blinds, HVAC stuff like thermostats, temperature sensors, TVs, access control, which is locks, garage door openers, safety and security products like sensors, access points, smart home controllers, and bridge devices. And those bridge devices could be Zigbee to Matter protocol, for example, or maybe it is Z-Wave to Matter. So that's where you're going to get like lots of information. For example, we learned earlier this week that Philips Hue light bulbs, they're going to still be Zigbee light bulbs because I bought my light bulbs 9 years ago. But the current generation Philips Hue hub will be retroactively flashed, if you update it, to work with Matter. And that will act as the bridge between Matter and the Zigbee bulbs that Hue uses.
That is super important because you won't have to replace all of your bulbs if you have Signify. Yeah.
And you won't have to replace your hub because they can do that one with a software update. Other devices may not, you may have to buy a new bridge to have it work with your existing Zigbee or Z-Wave devices.
Yeah, there weren't details on that. And that's going to depend on each device maker, how they're going to handle that. Maybe it's going to be a USB stick that adds thread. Maybe it's a whole new bridge. Maybe it's a flash like what Philips Hue is doing. And that obviously is the most ideal situation. So
yes. So, and the benefits of this are that now I can add all of those light bulbs one time to like a controlling device. Maybe it's my Google device, maybe it's Amazon Echo. And then eventually, if I want to swap out, I can just add it to the next layer without having to do reconfigurations and making it really complicated. I won't lose my routines and things like that.
Right. They get a standard language, device-to-device language that will work across the ecosystems. And that's really getting rid of a major pain point for people who have multiple smart home platforms, for example, in their house, like I do, or they want to switch, et cetera. So that's awesome.
Yeah. And not every device is supported. So like cameras, I don't know, that's going to take a while. We'll hear more about that from Kevin Poe, though. So stay tuned for him. The other thing is we sent, all of this stuff is actually public. You can go to the Matter GitHub repo, and Kevin did. And Kevin, what did you find?
Yeah, so there's a lot of what you just explained in there. If you look through the code, it's pretty well explained and documented. The documentation is very good. But there's also some things in there that they didn't talk about yet, which gives us a glimpse of where this is headed or what they'll be adding to it. Initially, I believe they're going to use the standard of using Bluetooth for device provisioning, for example, which is pretty common. And it sure beats creating like Wi-Fi peer-to-peer networks to get your smart device on your Wi-Fi network. But they've also got some other things in the works where they're working with some near-field radios and QR codes, as well as they have something called the Android chip tool that you can download, which is an Android app to provision something over Wi-Fi. So there are going to be multiple ways to provision, but they should be very simple and seamless. And that's the goal. Think of it kind of like how HomeKit does it today. It is really drop dead simple. They're going to give multiple avenues, but it doesn't matter what radios are used. It should be as simple as that to add a new device. Additionally, I found, and this has probably been available for a while, I just happened to notice it in here. So You can build your own Thread border router today if you have other Thread devices that you want to try and use. There's a way to do it with a PC, a desktop PC, and a Docker container if you want to go that route. You would need to add a radio chip that has Thread support, which costs about $50. But you could also do this with a Raspberry Pi 3 or 4, and all the instructions are in there for, you know, the people who want to get their hands dirty. Additionally, and this is kind of funny because of my second life of covering Chromebooks and Google efforts, I often look at Google's Chromium code repository, which is where I see what Google is adding to Chrome OS and Chromebooks for the future. And last week, I saw them talking about something called Zephyr. And Zephyr is a low-power, real-time operating system, open source, that some devices are built on now.
It's super popular.
Yeah, and gaining in popularity, in fact, from what I've seen. But I'm like, what does that have to do with a Chromebook? Well, maybe nothing, because it turns out there's a lot of references to Zephyr in the GitHub code repository for Matter. And that tells me that instead of each device maker having to create their own little platform to get things going, they could just use Zephyr as the RTOS to run their device if they want. They don't have to. I don't know that all of them will, but it's available. And there's a lot of information about how that works with the Matter stack and Bluetooth and Thread. So I thought that was very interesting. And then the last thing, this is probably a little too geeky for most people, but I wanted to see how these devices actually talk to each other. And they're basically using something that you probably don't see every day, but you use it every day, or at least your apps do. And that's called JSON, or JavaScript Object Notation. And I won't get into the details here, but basically it's a list of pairs of information. And by looking at those pairs of information, you can see what commands will be supported by Matter devices, such as door locks that have, and the door state can be reported. The actuator can be enabled or disabled. You can set up, it's available for pin access or not available for pin access. So I looked at some of these for scenes and for door locks, and just to see what is going to happen. But again, the takeaway is this is just a standard, commonly used today, internet protocol for these devices to talk to each other. So that's more of how Matter works. And again, most people won't care about that. But the fact that what it's going to do when it works, giving you that freedom from ecosystem, that's what you want to care about.
All right, we are going to move from Matter and go to the Colonial Pipeline hack. Because, holy cow, the East Coast of the U.S. is currently, well, they're experiencing gas shortages. I don't know if people are just panic buying or what's happening.
There's reported gas shortages and a lot of media hype over this, and it may be a biggest issue, as they're saying, but I don't see anybody in my neighborhood rushing around with, you know, drums of gasoline to take home. Prices probably are up, but hey, I don't get out much, so maybe.
Yeah. All right. So Kevin's less worried, but Kevin also lives and works at home. So let's talk about what we know. We know that a hacking group that is affiliated with Russian language sites called DarkSide, they're relatively new. They actually inserted malware into Colonial's IT systems. And in an abundance of caution, once they saw that they had malware on their site, Colonial Pipeline shut the pipeline down. They did this because if you have a pipeline transmitting a volatile substance, you have to be 100% sure it's safe and the operations are safe. And they couldn't figure that out because
they were locked out because of ransomware.
Because they were locked out because of ransomware. So it's important to note that DarkSide did not do something like, I'm trying to blow up a pipeline. What they did is they put ransomware on the IT systems, so like email and data. But Colonial was like, holy cow, we don't know what we don't know. And, you know, we don't want to cause a big explosion, so we're going to shut it down.
That's the right move.
That is the prudent move. And this is a tough situation because really digital transformations are all about combining the IT and the OT in a lot of ways, right? I'm not saying that you should put everything on the same network, but this is where we're heading. And so it's a good example to show, A, you have to constantly monitor everything. You have to be aware that things like malware are going to affect your actual operations. And you have to be aware of where your IT networks and OT networks can overlap. And it sounds like they didn't know that.
Yeah. I mean, when we think of cybersecurity, I think it's pretty prevalent to think of the direct attacks. This is more of an indirect attack that I bet you most companies don't think about, and that is the two systems. Like the OT system wasn't hacked. It, like you, as you said, these guys didn't like try to blow up the pipeline, shut it down, flood it with gas, do anything like that. Instead, they hit the IT systems that help control that, and that's an indirect attack. And that's something that people have to start thinking about. If you're a company that's digitizing everything, your systems obviously talk to each other. So you've got to not just focus on the direct, but also the indirect attacks.
Yes. And it's worth mentioning that DarkSide...
They're a nice bunch.
I don't know if we want to call them an ethical ransomware organization.
They feel bad.
They feel bad about this. They actually advertise to people that they will not attack certain targets. So they don't attack healthcare because they don't want to like kill people. But I don't think they were maybe aware that this would happen.
They just want to make money, they said. And they basically put out a statement that we'll be more careful about picking our targets in the future, which isn't that sweet of them.
Yeah. So they don't attack healthcare. They don't attack funeral services, which actually there was a hack and people, there was a challenge with burying bodies during the COVID crisis because somebody hacked.
About like blowing up a funeral home by turning on the cremation fire to overload or something.
Okay. No. Anyway, no.
You see how my mind works.
The other thing to think about, and this is really important from a, hey, IT security people thinking, like helping them learn how to think like an OT security person. Bringing up the pipeline is not a matter of just restarting some servers. Physically bringing up a manufacturing plant, a pipeline, some sort of big physical operation is actually a very highly prescribed process that can take a long time. So it's not like Colonial Pipeline can flip a switch. It's going to take them, we don't know how long actually, but it's going to take them a while to get everything back up and running, even once they have their data and can assess the problem.
Right. So. Yeah, it's not like when the pipeline went live, they just flipped a switch. There was a lot of prep time, a lot of system checking, a lot of things that
multiple
had to happen.
Multiple switches that were switching.
Yes.
Yes. If you ever, like, they call them turnarounds in the oil and gas and refinery business. You know, Google turnarounds of a plant, and you will just be shocked. It's impressive. These things don't go down casually, and they don't come back up casually. All right. So, moving right along. Other big news. This is the second big trend. If Matter is the first big trend for 2021, the second big trend is Amazon's Sidewalk network. Late last week, Amazon announced a deal that Tile would be using Amazon's Sidewalk network. To recap, the Sidewalk network is the network that Amazon said they were building for their Ring devices. It is a low-power, wide-area network designed to provide connectivity to devices that are farther outside the home.
And are they really building it, or are we really building it?
Okay, that's fair. So what Amazon is doing is they are putting Sidewalk-enabled chips, and they're using the 900 megahertz band for this. This is unlicensed band. You can use LoRa radios. You can actually use BLE radios, so Bluetooth radios, which is what Tile's doing. And you basically put the Sidewalk protocol. So this is software on top of those radios, and then it's part of the Sidewalk network. And that allows you to do things like tracking. And all the way back in 2019, when Amazon said they were going to do this, I was like, hot diggity, this is awesome. Because what they're building is a low-power, wide-area network for the Internet of Things that matches the cost structure of IoT devices. So if you think about building a dog tracker, if you want to put a cellular like radio on it, A, it's going to be expensive, it's going to be heavy, and it's going to consume a lot of power. Those are all terrible things. If you put something like Bluetooth low energy, that's cheap, but we don't have dense enough networks for it. So like when I bought a Tile once and stuck it on my dog, I had to knock on my neighbor's doors and be like, hey, can you download this app just so I know where my dog is? And they actually did. They're very nice. So with Sidewalk, Amazon's solving the density issue with these sorts of lower cost networks. So any Echo device that after the fourth generation, the latest generation Eero devices, Ring Bridges, all of those should soon have the Sidewalk network enabled on them. And when that happens, anywhere there's one of those devices with that capability turned on, you'll have a little bit of connectivity so you can track a tile tag or even, you know, some sort of, you could provide connectivity for the Ring mailbox sensor, for example. Right now, that is not on the Sidewalk network. It is on the Wi-Fi network.
Right. And you had started this point by saying that you're building an IoT network, which they are. I'm going to throw this at you. They're building an IoT network for works with Amazon devices.
Well, they're building it for works with Sidewalk. Will Sidewalk become a standard or protocol? Maybe. Would it be better if they did something like LoRa? 100%. But
right.
Being able to use Bluetooth is kind of relevant here. So
True.
Here's a parallel. Matter is an application level protocol that is running on top of Thread and Wi-Fi, right? You're seeing the radio protocols are not providing enough either data models and information about things or security. And so they're having to build another standard on top of those. We can argue all day long on whether we want all of that done that way, right? Like most hardcore internet people are going to be like, keep it at the radio layer. But as these things get more complicated, as we build out bigger networks and require more things of them, we do have to abstract some of this other stuff out if we want things to work together. So I get why they're doing this. I mean, is it ideal? Maybe not. Will it get us where we want to go? I think so. So the parallel here, and then we'll probably stop talking about it for a while because, man, we've been talking for a long time, is most people are going to be like, wait, what does this mean for Apple AirTags?
Which this deal came out the day after AirTags were available.
Yes. So this is clearly a response in some ways to Apple's AirTags. This is Tile and Amazon together will have a more dense location tracking network. Worth noting is that a lock company called Level also said that they would use the Amazon Sidewalk network. And I think they threw that in there because I think that's emphasizing the security aspects that Amazon wants to emphasize.
Well, plus Level locks, I believe, are HomeKit compatible. And that's just kind of a dig, I think, at Apple and its own network.
Level locks are very interesting. We're going to hear more about them. Okay. A little foreshadowing there for you. I think the way to think about this is Amazon is trying to avoid building a really like capital-intensive network for the Internet of Things, but it will let other companies use it. And so Amazon is building an IoT device network that should be very cheap to use and fairly easy to implement because you could throw it on top of your existing BLE devices or you build a new device that uses LoRa. Apple is building a tracking network. And this is really subtle, but I think it's worth mentioning. Apple is building a very specific network for tracking consumer devices. People are already trying to like shoehorn it into enterprise things, and maybe Apple will get there eventually. But right now, it is a consumer tracking device. Amazon's like, yeah, we can do location tracking, but we can also do data. Is your door sensor open or closed? Or your mailbox sensor open or closed? Is what's the temperature or moisture levels in my garden? And I think that's far more interesting because it looks more like a generalized service.
True. It's a broader spectrum of, no pun intended, of data that people want.
Yes. So I'm not betting against Apple's AirTags. I think they're fine. I think focusing on the fact that Tile is using Amazon's network to compete with AirTags maybe a little bit better is worth mentioning. But I think the real thing to focus on is Amazon is creating an ad hoc, cheap, low-power, wide-area IoT network.
So we'll get better package tracking from Prime.
Ooh, maybe.
Maybe.
In other Amazon news, we have upgraded Echo Show devices and a brand new Echo Show 5 for kids. These are basically Amazon is adding the face tracking to its Echo Show 8s.
Yes.
It's a fancier camera. It's not going to rotate like the Echo Show 10 does.
But it'll use software to pan around as you move, which is nice. And it'll even zoom as well during video calls.
Yeah. And the Echo Show 5, you know, this is a smaller version. It gets new colors.
And the kids version of the Echo Show 5.
Yeah. And it's got a better camera because people are using their cameras to make video calls. You can use that camera to check when you're out of town. You can open it up and look and see what's happening. You could do this with Echo Shows all the way back to the first one. I actually used to do it, but now they're going to advertise this.
Yes. I was surprised. I thought since these just came out this week, which was the week that we got Matter, and Amazon is part of that whole alliance.
Shebang.
I thought there'd be a Thread radio in here, but I don't see it in the specs. I see Bluetooth and Wi-Fi.
Yep. Well, that actually makes sense. So Wi-Fi for Matter will run over Wi-Fi for data-intensive things. So it's possible that because these have video cameras, they're thinking this is a Wi-Fi.
Yeah, but my thought was this could be a Thread border router since it's always plugged in.
Oh, I see. So the border routers basically act as a bridge between Wi-Fi and Thread.
Bingo.
Devices in the home. Yeah.
Just like the HomePod Mini. Yep.
So right now, this does not have that functionality. Maybe one day it will. Who knows? It has to have that radio. And they don't apparently have it yet. Okay. Moving right along, Wyze Buds Pro. Wyze, our favorite.
Has it been a few weeks since we've seen a new Wyze product? It has.
Yeah, so they're doing earbuds now. It's $59.99. You've got active noise cancellation on these earbuds. You know, you could pry my very expensive Jabra. I've got the 75T Elites. I freaking love them. I will never switch from these until they just start sucking, like Jabra stops making good quality headphones. But
do they have active noise cancellation?
They do. I actually got a software update that gave me active noise cancellation.
Nice. Well, the Wyze Buds Pro do as well. You're going to get 4.5 hours runtime with the active noise cancellation on, 6 hours with just regular usage.
Yes.
But there's a recharging case.
There's a recharging case, and this is fine. I don't even know what to say. This is
this fine.
If you want some cheap earbuds, you know, you can look at these and see what you think.
Okay.
I wish I had more to say. I do not. Let's talk about security. This is a little bit more involved. Here we are again.
Frag attacks.
Fragmentation and aggregation attacks. This is new security vulnerabilities that affect Wi-Fi devices that go all the way back to 1997. Basically, there were issues with the protocol and they haven't been fixed. But these are hard for you to abuse or hard for hackers to abuse. So really, this is not a risk. Do not ceremoniously toss out all of your Wi-Fi stuff because you only will have this if you've worked on your Wi-Fi products and protocols and done some weird settings. So that's our first thing. Don't freak out. And
there's multiple attacks that are listed in here, multiple CVE numbers if people are familiar with those. But yeah, I wouldn't panic. I mean, apparently these are fixable. In fact, in 2007, they had pointed this out as a threat model and said, okay, well, it's not an obvious attack. We'll look into it. And they just never got around to it. I mean, I haven't heard of any massive exploits taking place because of this.
Yeah. And part of one of the issues is like a handshake issue. So when your Wi-Fi device hits on the network, it calls the network. It's like, yeah, I'm this. Can I come on? And the Wi-Fi device is like, let's see if you're allowed. Here's some information to set up the SSID and password. And then the device is like, okay. And then the Wi-Fi network, you know, if you don't give it the right response, it says, no, you can't come on. Well, in this attack, what happens is when the device calls in, it looks like a handshake, but it's not a handshake. There's like a little bit of malware in there. And the Wi-Fi router will say, hey, and then suddenly it's like, I'm infected. So that is one of the issues. But again,
one specific thing that is worth noting, I think, is most Wi-Fi devices, especially older ones, don't send fragmented frames according to the research. However, this is actually used heavily in Wi-Fi 6.
Oh, no. But they can adjust that. All of that's new,
correct.
And
it's
people care about Wi-Fi 6 right now.
Yep.
Like, if it were like Wi-Fi N or whatever, yeah, maybe you should worry. But I would not worry now. All right. Next up, Finn. the company that makes the water leak detection modules or devices, they have several. Well, they've now launched a leak detector. And this is pretty cool because it is a puck-sized leak detector that has a two-year battery life. And it's $40, which is a really reasonable cost for one of these. My current favorite water leak sensor is about $70. It's a Honeywell. But yeah, this monitors for temperature, humidity, and leaks. It will notify you via text message, a mobile push notification, and an audible alarm and flashing LED lights on the device itself. If you connect it to their water shutoff device, it will actually shut off the water, which would suck if you spilled water near your thing, but that's okay.
Yeah. And one of the reasons I've never looked into adding any of these to my home, any water leak detectors, is I don't always have an outlet near where I want to monitor.
That is true. And the puck is kind of large sized. So they've also have an extension node that plugs into the puck and is really teeny. And that can go like underneath your washing machine or behind your water heater or underneath your water heater, whatever.
You can even daisy chain the cables to, because they're 4 feet long. So you can create a 12-foot coverage area for leak detection, which is nice.
Yes. I love having the cable be part of the sensor because it widens the area. You can also do something like wrap that around a pipe and you can use that to detect smaller leaks on pipes. So, okay. Very exciting. I like this expansion in the Finn lineup. And yeah. So if you're all in on Finn, you may want to check this out.
Even if you're not, I mean, which I am not, I would use this for $40. Just to get the notifications.
Now, $40 gets you the big puck. If you want the cable, it's $25. If you want the T90 little puck that goes onto the cable, that's $10. So now you're back at $75, which is about, the Honeywell sensor is about $70, and it gets you the cable and the...
Does the Honeywell need an outlet?
The Honeywell does not need an outlet. And I just took a look at it, and it is, right now, it is $80. So... Yeah. So Finn is still slightly cheaper. There you go. But you can also daisy chain cables together and that sort of thing. Okay. Oh, but it doesn't have flashing lights on the sensor itself. It does make a really loud noise. My dog hated it when I was testing it. Okay. Let us move on to the Internet of Things podcast hotline. This week's hotline is sponsored by Ayla. Ayla IoT offers a modern platform and solutions to enable manufacturers and service providers to develop secure connected products that will accelerate digital transformation initiatives. Ayla now has something called Fast Track, which is an innovative and turnkey IoT business model designed with a focus on simplicity for the fastest time to market at the lowest project risk. You can learn more at aylanetworks.com. Okay, so with the hotline, I just want to remind everybody that you can call us and we will answer your IoT or smart home or whatever questions. I don't know, existential questions even. If you dial 512-623-7424. And if you call us, you will be entered to win the smart speaker of your choice. So get on that, y'all. This week's question comes from British Columbia. Let's hear it.
Hi, Stacey and Kevin. It's Ian from British Columbia, Canada. I have a question regarding Red and Bluetooth. Do you think that eventually Red will end up in things like phones and iPads and stuff and replace Bluetooth for control over home networks and even onboarding new products? So instead of using Bluetooth to set up new devices, it'll just be done directly through Thread with a Thread chip in a phone. Thanks. Hope you all have a great day.
So we sort of hit upon this, part of this answer, earlier when we were talking about the GitHub information at Matter, because they have outlined and even showed a flow diagram of provisioning. But either way, whether it uses a phone or some other device, it starts with Bluetooth. And that makes sense to me because Bluetooth is essentially ubiquitous in phones and tablets. So I personally don't foresee mobile devices getting Thread radios inside. There really isn't a need for them because once the Bluetooth connection is made, the device can be connected to Wi-Fi or an existing Thread network by itself. You're not gaining anything. So I don't I don't think it's going to happen, but that's just my take based on what I've seen. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree with you. Now, I will say, I don't think Bluetooth is leaving phones. So
No, not at all.
Bluetooth is still going to be in many places. And I say that because, you know, there's all of our wearable devices tie into that, all of our audio listening.
It's a way to replace wires, essentially.
I agree with you that it may not have a huge role in provisioning forever or with every device, especially because QR codes are really easy for most people.
Yeah, I mean, Bluetooth is great for that initial connection. What happens after that, whether it's Wi-Fi or Thread, I don't know that, you know, that's going to really matter at the end of the day.
Oh, I really hate that it's called matter. Every time we say the word matter, I'm just like, ah!
I know.
I mean, I don't hate it, but it's aggravating.
It'll take time to get used to after almost 2 years of Project Chip.
Yeah. But like we said, I think last week, Bluetooth isn't going to go anywhere. I don't think Thread is going to be on phones for any time to come.
Even in speakers, for example, you're replacing wires with Bluetooth or Wi-Fi. You're not going to use Thread for that. Thread can't handle that type of throughput. It's not meant to. Thread is specifically for device-to-device communication.
And that does mean that you're going to have in your smart home some device that functions as a Thread border router. Your Thread sensors, they're going to have some sort of quote-unquote hub to be their border router.
And I look at that as a gateway to get the data onto your Wi-Fi network and or onto the cloud.
Right. And to talk to your phone or whatever else. Yes.
Right.
Now, you can have local control once that's set up where things are using Thread to control. Like if you've set up things on whatever your border router device is, like scheduling or voice commands, that could happen locally. But you're still going to need that device.
Yeah, as it stands today, I'm using an iPhone 12. It does not have Thread in it. When I want to control or get data from a Thread device, I use an app, for example, say the Eve app, to check the weather. That request from the app goes over Wi-Fi to the Wi-Fi-enabled HomePod Mini, which translates or pushes that data request onto the Thread network. But there's no Thread in my phone.
Okay. So that's what we think is happening probably for the next few years. I mean, and if we see this changing, we will let you know.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Thank you so much, Ian. Remember, if you want to give us a call, we're at 512-623-7424. And if you call us before the end of May, you will be entered to win a smart speaker of your choice. And right now, your odds are pretty good. That concludes this segment of the show. Stay tuned for our guest, Kevin Poe of Google, who is going to be going deep into the Matter protocol, what it's going to enable, and the security aspects. But first, a message from our sponsor. This week's sponsor is Very. Hey everyone, we are taking a quick break from the Internet of Things podcast for a message from our sponsor. This week's sponsor is Very, a leading IoT engineering firm, and I have Bill Flaherty here, who is the hardware practice lead at Very, ready to talk to us. All right, Bill, so I understand that your team has a fairly unique approach to hardware development. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's right, Stacey. Most hardware development practices are decades old, and while software development practices have evolved, hardware is mostly stuck in the 20th or even 19th centuries. Instead of accepting the status quo, we've got a new way of doing things, agile hardware development.
All right. Agile hardware development. That sounds interesting, but what does that actually mean?
Well, just like for software, agile hardware focuses on encouraging tight team collaboration, constant interaction with the customer, and being receptive to change rather than tied to a requirements document. We focus on designing and prototyping small bites of work instead of trying to engineer the whole system all at once. That allows us to iterate quickly, identify issues sooner, and get to market faster.
Excellent. So Very is a 100% remote company. How does that work with hardware development?
We have advanced hardware labs in each engineer's home. That means we can build a prototype for clients quickly and efficiently. We can build, break, and repair hardware on a very rapid cadence.
Oh, so you're breaking hardware on purpose?
Yes. When a large hardware prototype fails after years of development, it can be both financially and emotionally devastating for the team. The difference with Agile is that we're building and breaking hardware early and often. Then we use that feedback to improve the design while the product is still in development. That may sound pricey, but over the long run, it'll save the organization money. It's kind of like the difference between a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage and a balloon mortgage. If you invest in breaking hardware prototypes early and often, you won't have that huge bill come due at the end of the project.
Nice. All right, Bill. Where do I go to learn more about how Very can help me with my IoT project?
You can reach out to us at verypossible.com/Stacy. That's verypossible.com/STACEY.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Internet of Things podcast. This is your host, Stacy Higginbotham, and today's guest is Kevin Poe, who is a senior product manager at Google. Hello, Kevin. How are you today?
Doing pretty well. Yourself?
Excellent. Okay, so we have had a big news week happening on the, I'm going to say, formerly known as Project Chip front. So Project Chip, which was a smart home interoperability standard, they came out with a whole new name and branding. Now it is called Matter. And the organization that is in charge of this is no longer the Zigbee Alliance. Instead, they changed their name to the Connectivity Standards Alliance. So that was like the big news bomb of this week. And Kevin, do you want to just tell us why we should care about Matter?
Absolutely. I think as many of us are aware in the smart home industry, you know, setting up your, like, it's like the smart home just doesn't quite work yet, right? It's a pretty frustrating consumer purchase experience, setup experience. And then to really make sure your device interoperate, it's really frustrating having them all kind of linked together and such. So, you know, by the time you're done, you generally need to be generally like a smart home super user to really make configuration you're really looking for. So Matter is really intended to really simplify that problem for users, right? Make it a really easy, less frustrating purchase experience as a really simple onboarding way for these devices that, to really interact with different apps and ecosystems that you actually want to have. And you ultimately have that choice of interoperability that you're actually looking for. So hopefully with it, then really everyone across the smart home ecosystem wins with a much better experience all around.
And we're going to get into some of the details of what that actually means for people like me as a, I'll call myself a smart home super user, but I really hate to have to be that. And then also for device makers. So we're going to get into some of this. But first, one of the things we heard about, and this was something I have been wondering ever since this was announced all the way back in December 2019, when, let's see, Google, Apple, Amazon, and Samsung all were like, hey, we're going to get together. We're going to create a standard for the smart home, and it's going to make everything work together. And I was like, that's crazy. It'll be awesome. And now we're finally here, and I still have a lot of questions. So let's talk about the concept that y'all announced called multi-admin. Can you explain a little bit what that's about?
So the multi-admin feature is really intended to solve one of the key pain points that users have around interoperability and choice in the home. So right now, I, as a user, if I am just beginning my experience with a smart home, maybe I might have one smart home device and I set it up with, you know, an app or a system or platform of my choice. And as I get more devices or I want to try out new experiences, then I generally have to go through a set of linking steps, largely like cloud to cloud based, to make that all happen. And so as I will try more and more of these experiences or I want to say like switch platforms or whatever the use case is, it gets pretty frustrating, right? Like you go through n number of these linking flows to kind of get the experience that you want. So multi-admin is really intended to solve this key pain point, really provide a seamless, you know, kind of one-step kind of process that makes it very easy for users to try out these experiences and also really have the choice and power to understand which devices am I connecting to the platforms and apps and stuff of my choice? So we think this is going to be a great benefit for users and really deliver on the promise of an interoperable smart home.
This is such an important topic. I'm going to go through some specifics and see if we know what's going to happen here. First up, let's take a multi-ecosystem household. Gosh, that sounds so silly. But I live with both Google products and Amazon products in my house. And when I'm feeling crazy, I even bring in HomeKit. So how would this help someone like me? Because right now I have basically, I connect all of my peripherals to three different brains, as it were. And I manage all three different brains. I would love to manage one brain and have those brains communicate to the other brains.
So with respect to the multi-admin feature, the ability to add and manage the devices becomes much easier. So say if you set set up a light bulb, for instance, with one platform, and you want to share it with the other two, then it becomes much more straightforward to essentially do that one step, right, and have these devices interoperate locally. This really becomes much more beneficial once you get to the many device cases. Like if you were to think of like the three or five, so maybe I have, you know, three light bulbs, one or two locks, for instance, and I want to go from, you know, the Google platform, for instance, and have it interoperate with, you know, one of the other kind of popular leading ecosystems, instead of me having to kind of go through two or three different apps to kind of get that setup flow, really you can kind of select all those from the one platform provider and then have those permissions to have the other platforms interoperate with it.
Got it. Okay. So I could have my Google platform and then I'd be like, oh, smart things, I'm going to just let you interoperate with the Google platform. And then here comes the fun stuff. And I love this. There's the ability to control things via devices, it sounds like. So maybe I want certain devices to have access to my Nest thermostat, but I don't actually want everyone or all of the systems to have access to my Nest cameras. And it sounds like this makes that possible as well.
Yeah, there's kind of two key tenets, right, with Matter itself. So one is it's a local application layer protocol. So it really kind of describes how these devices speak the same language over those clearly defined IP network layers. So things like Thread, Wi-Fi, you know, Matter is a protocol that speaks on top of it. On the second one, it's really around user choice. And so ultimately, the user can really choose which devices they want kind of permissions to talk to with the different platforms and apps of that they consent to. And so just the ability to share, right, or to permit other platforms and apps to kind of discuss, really the user must, you know, provide some additional information and approval, right, that they want this to happen. And then, you know, the protocol will kind of work its magic to enable that the interaction that they choose.
And you mentioned local, which everybody is really keen on, or at least everybody who listens to this show is like super pumped about local, simply because of the privacy, latency factors. And with Matter, it sounds like obviously local control is important, but it also sounds like companies may not even have to develop their own apps if they don't want to have that kind of infrastructure layer to build on top of their devices, for example. Can you talk a little bit about kind of local control versus what might happen with cloud control from a device maker's perspective?
Yeah, you touched on a key benefit for device makers. So for those who choose not to create their own apps or manage their own cloud, but you want to, you know, bring a connected device to market, then the Matter protocol is a great solution for them, where they can integrate the connectivity protocol itself, have that kind of work in their device of choice. And really, for their users, those users can choose which system, right, they want to seamlessly set those devices up to and have that level of interaction. We're really kind of excited that we can ultimately help those device makers save costs, get faster time to market, and have that interoperability that their users are looking for too.
Yes. Yes. Interoperability. Cheer. All right. Another big thing to think about here. What about security? I know that I've gotten excited about this idea of having a blockchain-based or a distributed ledger that's going to be able to check, you know, for vulnerabilities and help you hopefully programmatically manage your home. Super forward-looking, but can you go into some of the security aspects that y'all have built into Matter?
Sure. Security, as you may have heard earlier today in the webinars, is a key principle that we really want to make sure that we do well with the Matter protocol. Because ultimately, many of these devices are going to be in yours, mine, and probably many other users' homes. And it's really the foundation of building trust, right, for all the kind of different interactions that everyone wants to deliver for the overall users. And so with that, we've approached security in every kind of part of the protocol itself. So that either could be through secure encryption of kind of the operational interactions of these devices together. It's also how these devices come into, through the setup experience, the provenance, as we call it, or the attestation as they come on board. But also as things, as you mentioned, through the distributed compliance ledger, like how do we securely send software updates to these devices to ensure that vulnerability and patches and stuff come about, we're able to get these devices updated in a timely fashion. And also just leveraging, you know, the benefits of a community. And so one of the key aspects with Matter itself is that there is a reference implementation that a number of companies are contributing into. And one of the benefits of an open source implementation is that there's many eyes, right, in the community that can look and see if the implementation has security issues that the spec itself might not have defined. And so as a community, we're able to find these issues, address it, and then, you know, with a lot of the infrastructure that we have in place, really kind of deliver these like a more secure home for users.
So as you're trying to make the smart home mainstream, and we all agree that security is crucial, but also security is really tough. And like things like two-factor authentication are horribly inconvenient. I know they're good, but they're horribly inconvenient for most people. So what can we expect to see from Matter when it comes to making these devices both secure and maybe easier for people to use in a secure fashion?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And this is where, from a Matter protocol perspective, there's been a lot of thought in how a lot of that complexity can be hidden from the user, right? And ultimately, you know, the Matter marking is one that can trust that security has been taken into account. So this could be everything in terms of how the protocols it works itself, but also what are the key touch points with the user through this? And so there's things like the software updates that I mentioned that could ideally, you know, take the complexity of the security patches and reduce that frustration point for the users. But at the same time, there's areas where there's, you know, user consent that's necessary, right, through certain steps that provide key user benefits. So this could either be, you know, proof of possession checks, either through a QR code or setup code that are there to make sure that that's in place, and potentially other areas too. So I think you could expect that from a protocol perspective, you know, the group is going to be taking a really kind of thoughtful approach to be clear where user kind of consent and interactions required, and making sure it's done in a thoughtful way and in a pattern that they're familiar with. And at the same time, where the protocol can take on more of the complexity, you know, the group will attempt to make that happen.
The Matter protocol is pretty awesome from a consumer and even from a developer perspective, because it does, like, having common data models makes it so nice to not have to reinvent the wheel. So big props for that. But I do want to think about, if I am a lock maker or a sensor company, I'm trying to understand where I should be thinking about adding my value, because historically, we've seen them try to like, oh, I'm not just a sensor company, I'm going to build an entire service around it. And Matter might make that more difficult. So I'm curious to see where you think the differentiation is and where companies can create value in the wake of this protocol.
With the Matter protocol itself, you know, it's really that interoperability and baseline setup that the group is really looking to, you know, reduce the friction and create more choice around. So ultimately, you know, the hope is that by aligning these things, then we're able to up-level, you know, where everyone is creating innovation, right? For instance, for device makers, they could potentially focus on overall sensor quality and then find better ways to, you know, detect users in the home. If they're a sensor one for a lock, you know, there's different ways for them to provide even more seamless technologies, right, to maybe do automatic locking or unlocking, right? For instance, you know, UWB is an increasingly prevalent technology these days. And so we could kind of see some of the innovation happening on that end. I think as you mentioned, even beyond just pure, I'd say, like sensing and actuation, there's richer services that these, you know, device makers can also create over time too. But really, it's they have the ability to kind of innovate in multiple different ways, right? And not have to worry too much around what's increasingly become just table stakes across the industry around that base interoperability and choice.
Got it. All right. And big question for you, because I actually use smart speakers or smart displays to control most of the things in my house, but I know others can use their smartphone, for example. So what is the role of a smartphone in the Matter ecosystem?
Ultimately, the way that the protocol has been defined is we really want to make sure that member companies have the ability to integrate it in whichever way they choose to deliver the value for the users. So for those who have displays or speakers, they can certainly do that, right, and have that kind of control experience. Similarly, for those who create mobile phones, they have the option to do that as well too. So I would expect that the Matter protocol is supported on, you know, any permutation of these by the different companies out there. You know, with it, then it could either be used for control, it could also be used to help set up these devices and such too. It just really depends on how the member company wants to adopt it.
Got it. All right. So I will not be tied, hopefully. My smart home and my phone can still be separate if I want it to be.
Yeah, it's ultimately around interoperability and choice. You know, as again, member companies adopt this, you're going to have richer options, right, to choose experience that you're looking for.
Okay. And then we have lots of device types so far: blinds, light bulbs, televisions, access control. I feel like we're missing a couple things. So I know we're missing cameras right now. We're missing like appliances. I still want to talk to my robotic vacuum in an interoperable manner. So when should we expect to see more devices get incorporated into the Matter protocol?
Yeah, so with respect to the different device types, we're really focused on landing that initial promise that we're, as an industry, we're really trying to target for the users. Then we can begin growing and scaling out the number of device types out there. So I would expect through the coming years, those device types that you mentioned are interesting ones to solve. And, you know, hopefully we'll be able to kind of, you know, build the Matter protocol, address them. I think some devices are certainly harder than others. With respect to cameras, for instance, there's, you know, multiple data control planes that, you know, we need to kind of think about on how to kind of, like, I'd say, make it more interoperable and such. So some might take a bit more time, but I think there's definitely a desire to really address, you know, the many use cases and stuff in the home and the many device types.
So what would you say to critics who look at the companies participating in this and they're like, oh, I think that this is a chance for like Google, Amazon, and Apple to just own the whole ecosystem, and I'm very afraid of playing?
I think for those who have those concerns, I think a lot of it is actually kind of is based on the foundations and the tenets of how we created the Matter effort to begin with. And that was really around interoperability and choice, right? And really kind of up-leveling the industry. I think if these members were to join the Connectivity Standards Alliance and actually see the work group in action, they would see actually a lot of the discussions that are occurring to really make sure that those core tenets are held, right, all the way through different key features in the protocol itself, be it setup, the multi-admin feature, or many more. At the same time, too, you know, I think seeing is a believing, and I think it's really dependent on the member companies adopting that technology and taking it on. You know, I think on Google's behalf, we're really big believers in Matter, and we're really excited to actually share more news about how we're going to be integrating Matter into our Google products at Google I.O. next week. So just stay tuned for that. And hopefully for those who, again, are a bit worried, right, they can kind of see our approach to the adoption that we're kind of approaching it to really address those two core user needs.
Got it. So wait and see if we walk the talk.
Yep. I think that would be a good way to frame it.
All right, Kevin, thank you so much for coming on the show this week. I appreciate you talking to us about Matter and looking forward to Google I.O.
All right. Looking forward to seeing everyone there. Thanks so much for having me on the podcast, Stacey.
That's it for this week. Thanks so much for listening. And remember, if you'd like more IoT news, sign up for my newsletter at stacyoniot.com. We'll see you next week.